Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. While all of us have been focused on the COVID-19 pandemic, a major recession, dramatic impacts of climate chaos, and election madness, the fossil fuel industry continues its efforts to build frack gas projects along the Columbia River. Today, we talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Danine O'Rourke with 350 PDX about the continuing saga of the world's largest methanol refinery proposed for Kalama, Washington. We'll also talk about a project in Umatilla County, where developers of the perennial Windchaser frack gas plant started clearing land illegally for a road at the site near the city of Hermiston. Dan and Danine, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
Well, in this post-election moment, where we're still waiting to find out if the current president will finally concede the election, there seem to be a lot of other things that are happening that most of us haven't really been focusing on. So today we're going to look at all the other things that go on while we're busy worrying about a pandemic and climate chaos and the integrity of democracy in our country. So let's first talk about this project that's been going on since, I do believe, 2015 up in Kalama, what would be the world's largest methanol refinery. And Dan, I just wanted you to start with an update about what's happening there, something we've been covering for years on this show.
Over the last couple of months, thousands of people across the Northwest have weighed in with the state of Washington urging the state to deny permits for what would be the largest gas to methanol refinery in the world. So the project would take up to 320 million cubic feet of fracked gas each day and convert that gas to methanol to be burned as a fuel or turned into cheap plastic overseas. This project in Kalama was proposed right along the shore of the Columbia River. The Department of Ecology in Washington is nearing a decision on whether to issue a shorelines permit, which would allow this company called Northwest Innovation Works to construct this refinery along the shoreline there in Kalama. So we're nearing a decision, and we are encouraging people on this No Methanol Monday to call Governor Inslee to welcome him back to his third term in office. Call him at 360-902-4111 and urge Governor Inslee to begin his administration in the third term by denying this climate wrecking project in Kalama. It was really a remarkable outpouring of opposition to this project during the climate fires in September when through, I think it was 11 or 12 hours of testimony, people weighed in over Zoom meetings, and Danine was part of this as well. And people just really couldn't believe that Washington would even consider building a climate polluter, a mega refinery at this scale in Kalama at this stage in the climate crisis.
Let's talk a little bit about the draft environmental impact statement, or the supplementary. It's actually the supplementary environmental impact statement, because I understand that people were not really thrilled with what the Department of Ecology came up with.
Yeah, I think the biggest flaw that we saw was, well, one, there was part of it that we really liked, which was it showed very clearly that the project would be a huge polluter, that it would generate, 4.6 million tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year for 40 years. So it clearly is just on the wrong side of the ledger as a massive, massive greenhouse gas polluter. Unfortunately, it entertained this idea that in the future, everyone else will forever use coal to make petrochemicals and fossil fuels for transportation. And it assumed that this fossil fuel-based methanol would displace some of that coal-based fossil fuel. And it basically gave credit to Northwest Innovation Works in this future 40 years for the difference, and said that that was a net potential future reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. So that type of analysis was, we thought, very, very, very speculative and not something that would warrant any sort of approval of a project that is guaranteed to produce millions and millions and millions of tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year. I mean, essentially what you're doing is you're locking in a version of climate catastrophe, whether it's version A or version B, doesn't really matter. It's guaranteed to be an unacceptable level of pollution.
Were you surprised that they came to that conclusion?
Well, it's not a conclusion yet. It's a draft form, and they heard, again, through hours and hours of testimony that this was a very questionable approach. And so we hope that ecology, in the end, comes back to the firm footing of, you know, what is assured to happen. And what is assured to happen is that this refinery will cause fracking, will cause methane pollution in the atmosphere, will cause the combustion of methanol as fuel that is based in fossil fuel, and that climate pollution will generate more climate fires and more smoke that people breathe and more impacts on future generations and current generations. These are the issues that we need ecology to keep in mind when they make their final decision. And again, this is why we're urging people to call Governor Inslee on this No Methanol Monday, 360-902-4111, and encourage him to start his third term by denying this methanol refinery.
I have this nice kind of rainy memory of a day back in January in 2018 when Jay Inslee pulled the plug on the what have been North America's largest oil by rail terminal in Vancouver. It did seem to be an indication to a lot of people that Inslee did get it and was on the right side. Now, a year and a half ago, Jay Inslee came out against this methanol refinery as well as the Tacoma LNG project. Do you think that that stand that he took so publicly, while he still said that the process had to continue all the way through to the bitter end, did that give you a sense that maybe he will decide to terminate this project?
I don't know. I think it's a very important decision for him to make. We don't want him to start his third term by essentially having a massive climate own goal by establishing this, you know, mega refinery that, you know, if you imagine Kalama 40 years from now still belching out 4 to 6 million tons of climate pollution each year, that's a climate catastrophe. That's just a completely unacceptable future to be living in. One that would be characterized by fires every summer and fall, rising seas, the types of impacts that Deneen and 350 and Sunrise, you know, that they were there to protest through many movements and inactions that have happened in the last several years. So I think Governor Inslee, his position needs to translate to action now, and that's what we're really focused on here with Kalama.
Well, Deneen, I learned last week from the guest that I interviewed that Sunrise Movement had a big influence on Joe Biden's campaign, and the reason why at the second presidential debate he was talking about frontline communities and fence line communities and really seeming to understand environmental justice issues was because Sunrise people had sat down with him. And I wonder if you feel like the momentum that young people have had in reaching political leaders in the mainstream, if that's some kind of momentum that you can push onto Jay Inslee now.
Right. Yeah, I think it's the youth climate leaders and it's environmental justice advocates that have been at this work for many, many years have, you know, we've seen been shaping policy now on the national level too. And now there's an opportunity to really get some very meaningful federal climate legislation. And I do feel hopeful after Governor Inslee's presidential bid this past year that this will be, you know, he wants to continue this legacy that he is trying to hold up of being a climate champion governor. And so that gives us as activists and organizers an angle to, you know, provide him the door to which he can be that champion for us.
Well, it was just a little over a year ago. I remember people converged at the Washington State Capitol. Actually, first they converged at the Department of Ecology to protest and to try to get ecology to do what they actually did, which is to take over the permitting process for Kalama Methanol. But then a couple of weeks later, people were back at the state capitol calling on Inslee to be the climate leader that he was claiming to be. And they had been trying to get him to speak at this rally in front of the capitol. And Inslee wasn't there, but there was a cardboard cutout that people posed for photographs with. I wonder if you feel frustration that he says one thing, but that he's not totally coming forward with actions that follow his words.
I have felt frustrated by that from politicians the entire time I've been doing this work in the climate movement. Yes, I think the the need to walk the talk is a really big problem that in a lot of ways we don't see our leaders doing that unless they are being pushed by movements and by grassroots organizers. And we know that a large part of our job as organizers is to create the parade that the politicians want to stand in front of and take credit for, and then, you know, make those decisions that we have been asking for years and years. And we are now, thankfully, you know, seeing that in a big way with the Jordan Cove fight in Southern Oregon, that for 15 years people were fighting this project, and for, you know, most of Governor Brown's tenure as our governor, you know, she was neutral on this and wouldn't take a stand. And now the state of Oregon is suing the federal government over the project, and that I attribute that to movements and the movements that are led in Oregon by folks in Southern Oregon directly impacted by this.
Well, Danine, I was reading your bio the other day and saw that you grew up, I guess, on Long Island, and you were in high school during Hurricane Sandy, and that was like the stimulus that made you into a climate activist. And I was thinking about that and basically just thinking about what it would be like, me viewing this as a much older person, viewing what it'd be like to be in high school and be experiencing something like Hurricane Sandy, and how that is shaping a very different kind of movement than the kind of movement that I was part of in the 60s and 70s when I was young. I wanted to talk a little bit about that and that kind of pivotal moment and how that is impacting what you're doing right now.
For most of my young adult life in middle school and high school, I was, you know, in our environmental club and like focusing on recycling and getting rid of styrofoam lunch trays and meeting with our principal about issues like that. And it was Hurricane Sandy to a T that like completely shifted the way that I think about environmental crises and the climate crisis, from being a problem that corporations are responsible for and that our political system has failed us in addressing. Yeah, I will never forget like watching the bay down my street that I grew up going to, that I learned how to swim in. That's usually, you know, as calm as can be, having waves, you know, up to the top of the swing set and like destroying this playground that I used to play on. And then going home and watching the coverage of this on our local news, and how for the months and months after this storm, people in my community and people covering this issue would not even mention climate change as a possible reason for why this storm was so much larger and why these storms are so much more frequent. I remember feeling my blood boiling with anger that like this, they're missing the lead here. This is going to continue to get worse. The millions of people who live on the sandbar of Long Island, New York, have one highway to leave, and it's incredibly dangerous. And Hurricane Sandy wasn't even a Category 1 storm when it hit, when it made landfall. And to even contemplate what a Category 4 or 5 would do to that area is devastating.
I want to jump ahead to the summer. Dan made a reference to those fires that were burning while those virtual hearings were going on about climate methanol. So I just want to get a sense from both of you about what it was like to live through the fires of September this year, which were something that I think in a way actually is comparable in a way to the unexpectedness of having a hurricane storm surge of the force that hit New York City with Hurricane Sandy. Because we don't think of New York City as being a place like Florida or New Orleans or the Caribbean, which is going to be inundated all the time with hurricanes. Here in Western Oregon, we don't think of having these kind of fires like they have in Paradise, California, or even in Southern Oregon. So how was that shaping you, especially when you're both at the hearings for the climate methanol refinery? What kind of juxtaposition did you see between what you were living and breathing in real time and what was going on in that hearing?
That really struck me about what Danine just said. You know, when I was in high school, I experienced the 96 floods, and I grew up in Oregon City. And it very much shaped the way I perceived rivers and the confluence of the Willamette and the Clackamas River where I grew up. And to hear what you describe, and to hear how climate change triggering that type of an event could affect people, and to hear them not being willing to accept that and to reckon with it. It's a powerful thing to have to think about. And then, you know, with the fires, they factored really heavily into the hearings. Nearly a majority of people who spoke began their statements by saying, you know, I am in my home with, you know, basically barricaded in, breathing smoke that, you know, is toxic to my lungs and making it difficult for me to speak. And, you know, many of us here had been working on different supply drives, or, you know, our lungs had been impacted. Some of us had been evacuated, or had families who were evacuated. And certainly our allies in Southern Oregon had been horribly impacted. And here in Clackamas County, where I grew up and live, a majority of the county by land was evacuated. It was just a shocking experience for many people. And like you said, people in California have been dealing with this for some time. And so this really kind of potentiated the discussion in the comments, you know, in these kind of 2-minute statements people kept saying over and over, like, I'm looking out my window and I'm telling you what I'm seeing cannot be addressed by building the world's largest gas to methanol refinery. Like, this is abjectly wrong to consider. Don't do this. Department of Ecology, you know your mission, you're good people, we know you have a hard job. Just please do the right thing right now for Kalama and for our climate. Say no to this. And I think that the people from all over the region, from Cowlitz County, from King County, from Portland, who spoke up, made both a detailed and heartfelt case that I found very compelling and moving. Something about the Zoom format actually kind of distilled these 2-minute mini speeches in a way that made it, for anyone who's interested, it would be really interesting to go back and listen to. It's also really interesting to listen to the people who are in favor of the project, many of whom spoke passionately about climate change and about the need for jobs, all of which is very valid. And I think that we're having parallel experiences in our communities and seeing real needs that need to be met. So a lot of those hearings were pretty cathartic and pretty intense.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Danine O'Rourke with 350 PDX about the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington, and the perennial Windchaser frack gas plant being proposed near Hermiston, Oregon. Well, let's move to this other project that's threatening the horizon. And, I mean, I think a lot of the listeners have been hearing about Kalama methanol now for several years, but I'm not sure how many people know about perennial Windchaser. So, Dan, why don't you give a little background on what's going on out there in Hermiston?
Yeah, so perennial Windchaser is a 415-megawatt fracked gas-powered proposal. This gas plant would be located out in Umatilla County, very close to the Hermiston Generating Plant, which is one of Oregon's biggest polluters. It would require a lateral gas pipeline to supply it. It would be a peaker plant, which makes it a little less efficient, so it would be able to ramp up and down, thus the name Windchaser. When it was first proposed back in 2014-ish and approved in 2015 by the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council, the idea was that this facility would ramp up and down when the wind would kind of fluctuate. So that it would kind of balance the variable amount of wind energy being produced and being fed into the Bonneville system. Now, no one ever decided to buy this proposal. It's a project of Sumitomo Corporation. It's basically a speculative idea, and so it's never made any headway, even though it has a certificate from the state of Oregon. At one point, it had an air pollution discharge permit from Oregon DEQ that has since expired, so it does not have a DEQ permit. It does not have a construction stormwater permit from DEQ. It never did. That ends up being very important, and we'll explain that as we talk more. Perennial has, through the years, been able to extend its site certificate with the Oregon Department of Energy. So though it was approved in 2015, never made any move towards beginning construction of this 415 megawatts. Danine, do you want to fill in just kind of some of the facts about the pollution impact of this project?
Right, yeah. So when this project was approved initially in 2015, you know, we have to remember this was before the real serious climate impacts of methane and fracked gas were fully understood. And so now what we're dealing with is, since during this time that we've been fighting perennial, just last month, the last coal-fired power plant in Oregon has gone offline, Boardman. So now that would mean if this project is built, it would be one of Oregon's top five polluters, generating about 1 million tons of pollution per year. All of the top five of Oregon's largest polluters are gas projects. And so that is really what we see as the main focus of our work going forward, is really educating people and our elected officials that gas is not the answer to our climate crisis, that it is exacerbating this crisis. What really concerns us at 350PDX is, you know, we have a governor who really wants to claim this mantle of climate leadership, but this is a threat to that, to that title that she wants to hold. She's really, we really see that she's at a crossroads right now, and like having to choose between what kind of future we need Oregon to be in.
Well, there's again this whole issue of jobs versus the environment. And I had had the sense from things that I'd heard Kate Brown say about Jordan Cove recently that she's beginning to understand that there is no conflict between jobs and the environment, and you can create a just transition and transition people who are working in the fossil fuel industry into jobs in renewables and in a green future. Do you think she's backsliding on this?
Governor Brown can, as governor, she has the power to appoint members to the Energy and Facilities Siting Council, the agency that has been allowing Perennial to continue forward with this construction. And so, yes, like we are very concerned with how she has been allowing EFSEC, the Energy Council, to move this project forward, and see it as in great odds with her desire to be a climate leader.
It sounds a bit like Governor Inslee. They both are put on the face of being these climate champion governors, but beneath that, there seems to be a lot of underground rumblings of control coming from the fossil fuel industry that they don't seem to be able to quite separate themselves from.
I think there's a tension, too, where some of the decisions that are being made by staff. And, you know, some of it is with political direction and some of it is not. Some of it is with pressure from the industry, obviously. And so how much does the governor come down and directly hold accountable, say, Director Benner, who's the director of the Oregon Department of Energy, for this really exceptionally bad thing that happened at Perennial, which we should get into. We should explain to folks what happened out at Perennial. What Deneen is describing is, I think, exactly right. Like, I think what we're calling for is, like, if we're serious about addressing this climate crisis, we need our climate leaders to use their authority where they can. We really, really need them to step up in this time of crisis in every way. And that's what we saw in the executive order. We were enthused by it. We saw that effort to like reach down to the agency level and to say, do what you can, where you can, to push further. And then in this Perennial case, it just directly abrogated and conflicted with everything that the governor had set forth. And so we really think it's time for her to hold someone accountable for it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the big problems that you're seeing that are going on right now with the way that Perennial is moving forward.
Number one, the Perennial frack gas plant had a requirement to begin construction by September 23rd, 2020. And if they didn't begin construction by this date, their site certificate would expire and they would have to get a new one if they wanted to continue with the project. Normally, a company would just go out and get an extension for the site certificate. And that would mean you'd have to get an amendment. By getting an amendment, that means you would have to pay this new updated carbon fee. And because Perennial is such a big polluter, this new updated carbon fee that Deneen and people at Oregon PSR and people all across Oregon had weighed in and gotten improved, this is a very moderate thing. Basically, mega polluters like Perennial have to pay a certain amount a dollar amount for excess pollution that comes out of the smokestack at these gas-fired power plants. Above a certain level, they're required to pay for the excess carbon pollution. They're held to a certain efficiency, and what gets emitted above that, you know, there's a penalty for it, essentially. And it's meant to incentivize them to be both more efficient and also to directly offset their carbon pollution. That would have kicked in if they had to get an amendment. To get around this, Perennial decides, we'll just pretend that we're beginning construction. So this is literally a big polluter deciding to sidestep Oregon's climate pollution rules. We will pretend to begin construction on a piece of road and a little bridge over an irrigation canal out in this field where this huge power plant may one day go. The power plant itself doesn't have a DEQ permit. Most of the other requirements for building the power plant have not been met. So legally, they don't have permission to begin construction. Janine Damon from Oregon PSR, Ryan Rittenhouse from Friends of the Gorge, a whole bunch of folks from Stop Frack Gas PDX weighed in directly with the Oregon Energy Council in August. We also sent a letter to them explaining that this company was about to break the rules and break the law by trying to build this road. We made it very explicit. We said we think they do not have permission, they do not have the legal right to begin construction, and they're just about to do it. You need to stop them, you need to intervene. So never in my experience has the public done such a good, clear job of saying, here we have a violator coming up clear as day out in the middle of Umatilla County. You know, you can see them out there literally. We have pictures of the piece of equipment parked the day before construction began, ready to begin construction, literally. And the next day they went out and built the road. And the Energy Council and the Oregon Department of Energy let them do it. And they essentially approved this because they said that only a tiny number of the pre-construction requirements applied. So they bent the rules, and ultimately they allowed them to break the law because the company didn't have a required Clean Water Act permit before digging up this road and crossing this irrigation canal. It's called the Construction Stormwater Permit. So they literally broke the Clean Water Act. After this, Columbia River Keeper filed a notice of intent to sue under the Clean Water Act against Perennial Wind Chaser. We've notified the Oregon Department of Energy that we are also challenging them in court for failing to implement their site certificate correctly, because Perennial did not legally begin construction by their construction deadline. All of this is very complicated for your listeners, I realize, but I just want to boil it down to the state of Oregon has bent and broken the rules for protecting our climate and making a polluter pay for its climate pollution so dramatically that it's plain as day. It's a road, it's a dingy little road in a field in Umatilla County that you can go out and you can drive out there and you can see it. And it's literal evidence out there that Oregon is not serious about addressing the climate crisis if we're going to allow polluters to behave in this manner. And so there's an opportunity here for the governor to hold someone accountable and to change the direction.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Danine O'Rourke with 350 PDX about the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington. And now we're talking about the Perennial Wind Chaser frack gas plant proposed near Hermiston, Oregon. I'd like to kind of follow up what you just said, Dan, with what do you think is going on for Governor Brown? She has done some really, made great statements and actually taken some really good steps in the last year. Why is she holding back from having her agencies actually enforce what you perceive to be state law?
I think she needs to hear from more of us. And I think that's where we can step up and step in and provide a loud, clear voice that in the wake of all these disasters that she will have support from our community for taking the action necessary to hold these polluters and these agencies accountable for protecting Oregon from this climate crisis and for steering us in a new direction. We know this is hard to do. It's a battle. And I want to extend some compassion her way too, and just say, like, we need to hold her accountable, but also show that we are a force. We're going to insist on this for years and years and years, because if there's no other option.
Well, Nina, I want to bring you back into the conversation, and let's talk about the lessons we've learned from fighting Jordan Cove LNG. How do you see the progress that's happened there on the state level perhaps being a roadmap for what can happen now in stopping perennial wind chaser?
Right. Well, again, so the way that I view our work as grassroots organizers, working with elected officials who do a lot of walking or talking and not enough of walking that talk, is we have to build the parade, make what we are talking about, everyone is in agreement about this, that the only way to fight the climate crisis in Oregon is to stop producing major fossil fuel projects. And that includes perennial wind chaser. So we've seen that clear as day with Jordan Cove and folks down in Southern Oregon, landowners, tribal members, young people, community members have, you know, made that parade that people around the whole region have gotten behind. And then after years and years, we also now have elected officials joining in. On my own time, I was one of the 21 people who were arrested in Governor Brown's office almost a year ago, actually. And we were arrested because there were 1,000 people at the State House demanding that Governor Brown use her authority to stop this project once and for all. And there were a number of people being led by folks down in Southern Oregon to occupy her office until those demands are met. We stayed there for 10 hours until we ended up having a couple of meetings with the chief of staff and with Governor Brown herself that did not lead to the result that we were looking for. So we didn't move. You know, a month after that action, we saw Representative Peter DeFazio come out against Jordan Cove for the first time. And then a few months after that, we saw the state of Oregon file suit against FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, for approving Jordan Cove. And I deeply believe in the power of nonviolent direct action and in the power of grassroots movements. And to me, that is a perfect example of how we have to create the line and the crossroads for these elected officials to see, and they have to decide who they're going to align with. And that's what is facing Governor Brown again right now in a very similar manner. Perennial does not have a plan for what this project and this power plant will look like. They don't have a buyer for the gas, and they don't have their permits. All they have is this road. That road was built right after our state was on fire, while tens of thousands of people were losing their homes, and while millions of people were breathing in the worst air quality in the world. I find that deeply unacceptable, that while all that was happening, the Energy and Facilities Siting Council allowed a major new polluter to break ground and begin construction. It's as if, you know, similarly to how I felt at times on the Kalama hearing, you know, looking at the red sky and then hearing Northwest Innovation Works representatives talk about how the only future we have forward is more fossil fuels. It does feel like we are living in two different realities sometimes. But Governor Brown does have the pathway, and we're really hoping that one of the main things she could do is to reform this broken Energy and Facilities Siting Council. And we need her to appoint people on this council who really understand the severity of the climate crisis.
Well, one of the challenges right now in doing the kind of direct action that people did last year at this time is that, as far as I know, the Capitol is closed. You could try to have a protest outside. People have been doing that, you know, arguing about not wanting to wear masks and things like that. You can rally outside, but you can't take over the governor's office, nor would anybody want to do that for all kinds of COVID concerns. So I wonder how, when we're living most of our life and our organizing life over Zoom, how do you figure to maintain that kind of pressure on Governor Brown so that she hears that everybody in the state who is really concerned about climate chaos, that they have her back?
Well, in some ways, I try to see the silver linings as much as I can. And one of them is that in some ways it is easier now to just pick up the phone. You don't have to go all the way to Salem and sit in her office for 10 hours like we did a year ago. You can just pick up the phone right now and call Governor Brown and tell her that you're concerned about perennial wind chaser and that you want to see her take immediate action to stop this project. And her number is 503-378-4582. We need to show her that a majority of Oregonians do not see gas as a path forward for Oregon's climate future, and that it brings us backwards.
Deneen, also, I wanted to acknowledge that you and a group of Sunrise activists did go to Salem and did do a COVID-safe action that Inside Climate News wrote about for a national audience, and people heard about this. It's a really good, in-depth story that laid out this situation with perennial and this kind of clash of values. And it just shows that, like, a relatively modest action at this time, like holding a banner that's just a very clear clarion call of no fracked gas plant in Oregon, like this thing would be the fifth biggest polluter in the state. Like, that visual image was really strong in combination with this long advocacy and policy work that's gone on, and it was compelling, and this story got out to a pretty broad audience.
A group of seven of us at 350 PDX and Sunrise PDX went down to Salem to have a COVID-safe action at the end of October, where we held these banners in front of a very empty Capitol building that we were not allowed to enter. But we were able to deliver a letter that was co-signed by 14 organizations across the state. We hand-delivered that letter to staff at the Oregon Department of Energy building. This new moment we're in right now just really requires a lot of creativity, I've found, with like the kinds of organizing we can do. And so we were able to deliver this letter, and that included demands to the governor and to the Department of Energy, and get that in their hands and show, really our main goal is to show that people are watching. Like, yes, we are, there's so much going on in the world right now. It's very stressful and scary. And I want to like recognize that and the work that Governor Brown is doing to address that. And I think with all of what's going on, it's important that we remind her, like, we know what's going on down this road in Hermiston, Oregon. We've been watching it. We have photos before, during, and after they started building this little road. We are watching this, and we think it is a disaster for Oregon's climate goals to move forward with this project. And so there are, you know, over a dozen organizations that are watching this very closely and are waiting and will continue to fight until Governor Brown does the right thing here.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Deneen O'Rourke with 350 PDX. And we're talking now about the perennial wind chaser frack gas plant that's being proposed near Hermiston, Oregon. Well, one of the concerns that I have about these frack gas projects continually popping up, as it seems, is that there seems to be a concerted effort on the part of the frack gas industry, and in this case in the Northwest, led by Puget Sound Energy, who's behind the Tacoma LNG facility, to do a lot of greenwashing and to do this whole PR campaign to promote frack gas as a clean, renewable bridge fuel to a more renewable future. And I'm wondering if you're seeing the manifestation of perennial wind chaser as another example of this kind of covert effort to really bring a lot more frack gas to the Northwest.
I think so. I think that the risk there is that the gas industry will attempt to exempt itself from further regulation as we move into a future where we're going to have to limit carbon pollution. we're going to have to find ways to establish fees and hold polluters accountable, the gas industry will try to hold itself apart and say that somehow it is special, it is a better fossil fuel, it's part of a renewable future in some way. It's literally greenwashing a fossil fuel. It's in the name, natural gas. Like, it's from the very beginning. Tarika Powell, formerly from the Siteline Institute, wrote some really great stuff back in 2018 and 2019 for Siteline that really boiled down a lot of the messaging that came from the gas industry over the last several decades. And we are going to have a struggle here to peel back that idea that the gas industry has a role to play at all in dealing with the tons and tons and tons of climate-changing pollution that comes out of not just the smokestacks, but the fracking wells and the pipes and the compressors and all the infrastructure that leads to this fracking gas system that is polluting our environment. So I think one place we're looking at this specifically is with Oregon's DEQ is looking at cap and reduce rulemaking coming up. The Environmental Quality Commission in 2021 will be developing new rules, and they've recently held town halls about this to implement rules that will regulate and potentially set limits on the amount of pollution that can come from big facilities. And it's very, very important that those rules apply to new gas plants or existing gas plants, that they require them to ratchet down the pollution that comes from these facilities. And ultimately, we're talking about, you know, needing to find a way to limit this type of carbon pollution overall, because it's leading to the climate fires that we experienced already. We're looking at that rulemaking as a really important thing coming up in 2021. It's wonky, it's down in the weeds, but again, it's something that may be a place that's tangible that the folks who are listening can apply some influence.
In the last part of the show, I want to get back to what Deneen was alluding to, particularly in describing the COVID-safe protest that Sunrise and 350 PDX organized at the Capitol to oppose the perennial wind chaser project. How do you, as activists who are also human beings who are living through some of the most intense crises of the last 100 years, how do you manage to continue to keep your eye on all these things that are trying to slip past us while we're worried about staying alive? We're worried about this horrible pandemic, which is getting worse now. And we're worrying about a government that refuses to cede itself and allow the next administration to come in. We're worried about all the impacts of climate change that we're seeing so viscerally now, with particularly the fires this year. And we're worried about threats to democracy that we're experiencing on the national level. And another thing I think we're worrying about is, how do we communicate with the 72 million people who voted for Trump and all the people who think that the election was stolen? So with that all being in the foreground and in the background, how do you keep going in fighting the fossil fuel powers to be?
It's a great question, and what I'm still, you know, daily grappling with. I think, you know, with at the core of just one piece that does give me hope with the task of the climate movement, one of the many tasks we have in the new phase we're in, in related to perennial, is, you know, gas, tackling gas is the road that's ahead of us. There's a lot of greenwashing, a lot of money being put behind everyday people thinking that gas is a solution. And so that is the work that's ahead of us right now, is debunking that. And this is something that the climate movement has had to do before. Remember how the word clean used to always be in front of coal? You know, this is that, and now people don't accept that anymore. You can't have clean coal. And that is because of years and years of organizing by folks directly impacted by coal projects and organizers on the ground. In our region too, in fighting Longview, for example. And so these are things that we've done before, and we will continue to fight and make sure that the narrative that's being shared is the truth. But in this time, with COVID and all of these intersecting crises that we're experiencing, I really do think one of the things that keeps me going is the need for creativity and the need to continue to see the folks that we work with as, you know, members of our community. And I know that I, at the height of the wildfires this September, I know that I would have felt a lot more deep despair had I not been doing these donation drives with folks in our community and seeing how our community mobilized to support folks down in Southern Oregon and Central Oregon, you know, with one call out, and then the offices were filled with donations, and we sent trucks and trucks down to Southern Oregon multiple times a day. So in those moments, I felt very much, you know, at home and held in a community that will be here for all of the future crises that lie ahead of us in this moment and in the future. And it gives me hope and comfort to know that we are part of, you know, such a tight-knit group of folks here who are committed to dismantling the fossil fuel industry and also supporting each other when we need to. So that whole donation drive really gave me a lot of hope.
Actually, it gave me a lot of hope, too, as one of those donors. And I remember driving down to the Sierra Club office from Selwood, and I remember getting out of my car and with all the toilet paper that I'd hoarded, you know, sending it down to Southern Oregon. And I just remember, like, being out there, and the air was horrible, and people were there, we were all wearing our masks, and there was this camaraderie, but there was also this purpose and the sense that we could surmount even the most horrible things. And at the same time, I knew that Rogue Climate's office had burned down. I'd been in touch with Ellie and Hannah, and I was pretty distressed about that. They seemed to be, in some ways, less distressed than a lot of us up here were, because they just kept fighting and just kept working on supporting people down there. Well, Dan, I see Deneen is kind of smiling a little bit. You look a little bit more serious. And I know the conversations we've had this week earlier that you've got a lot on your mind in terms of dealing with what's going on with perennials. So I wonder how you're coping with all of this and being able to balance and juggle the insanities that are going on around us with this purpose of just staying focused on stopping all these frack gas projects.
Yeah, I think that what I'm impressed by is the upsurge of leadership from folks like Deneen and Allie and others who are young and have this real vision of intersectionality and energy, who have intercepted this crisis, these multiple crises that have come in and kind of weaved together the issues of climate and public health. And I've seen the work that Oregon PSR has done, and Portland Harbor Community Coalition has been doing this, and people with the Braided River Campaign, and all across, you know, you see all these different efforts where people are really trying to stitch together kind of institutions to address a very, very difficult time of dislocation. But I think that the people from the fossil fuel interests see an opportunity here to move quickly and to take some ground in Oregon and in the Northwest quickly. And for a long time, we have been playing defense and playing whack-a-mole. And I think that what I perceive is just an amazing effort. And I want to acknowledge over the last several years. Now, if you look across this administration, the Trump administration, what people have accomplished in holding the line on things like the Tesoro Savage oil train terminal, the Kalama refinery, you know, it is not built yet. Tesoro Savage didn't get built. Jordan Cove remains unbuilt. Perennial, you know, they've got their dingy little road, but, you know, there's no buyer. It's sitting out there, you know, unbuilt. So many more examples of things like that where people have worked hard to hold that thin green line. And I just want to acknowledge that that has fallen on volunteers and people who've strained their health to make this happen, and tribal communities and leaders and rural communities and communities of color, and people who've also been dealing with police violence. It's just been an extraordinary time, and what I've kind of as an outsider observed in many ways has just been kind of staggering and heroic, and I appreciate the opportunity to, you know, just to acknowledge it.
Well, just thinking in terms of the long term, I got a text from a friend yesterday alerting me to an article in the Oregonian about how the first dam on the Klamath River that was supposed to actually be taken out originally this year, that I guess the process stalled, but now it's going back into gear. And it looks like that dam is going to be removed soon. And I remember talking with Taylor Tupper a year and a half ago about the struggle to get rid of the dams on the Klamath River and how long the tribes fought and fought and fought. And I mean, basically decades. And they have succeeded. And I think that there's a lot of lessons we can learn from indigenous people in our region who have been fighting way longer than a lot of the rest of us have to protect this land. What are some of the lessons that you're seeing that we can take forward? And also, how might that help us to find some better alliances with people who voted for Trump who might not understand the issues exactly the same way that we do?
Well, I think what we have on our side is the science, the morals, and the, you know, the majority of American people, and this breaks party lines, the majority of American people believe that the climate crisis is human caused and that we need to do something about it. So it just means that we need to, it means building alliances. And I do really think we keep going back to Jordan Cove LNG, because it is a great example of that, I think. You know, there are alliances in that coalition of, you know, Republican Trump voters who are, you know, in it to defend their land, folks like us, climate activists, in it, you know, to fight the climate crisis, tribal leaders. It brings, these fights are unique and exciting to me because it really does bring together folks that don't normally organize together or don't vote in the same way. We saw that a lot with Keystone XL, folks in Nebraska defending their land. So yeah, I think in a lot of ways in this work, I see myself as a serial optimist because I think I have to be, or else it would be a lot more challenging to fight an industry as large as the fossil fuel industry. But, you know, part of that is one of the first campaigns I worked on when I started college was a Kinder Morgan fracked gas pipeline, the Northeast Energy Direct, that we fought really hard at every single angle for 3 years. And then Kinder Morgan pulled out of the project from FERC. Since, you know, that kind of set me forward as the first campaign I really worked on and gave me a lot of feelings of power, that grassroots organizing, there are countless examples that we can name to show how well that works. And it's all about being the majority and sharing the moral choice that our politicians have to make.
And how about you, Dan?
I don't think I have anything to add on what Deneen just said. I think that was really beautifully put.
Well, it's really great to have you both on. And it's really great, Deneen, to have you on and to get your perspective as somebody who's a whole lot younger than me and actually a whole lot younger than aging Dan Sears, who was a kid when I first met him. And it just gives me so much hope to see the energy coming from people who are under 30 and what you can be doing and what you are doing and showing us how to live into this future that is a very bizarre future to be facing. Dan and Deneen, thanks so much for joining us. It's really great to have you on today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, Barbara. And if I can make one more plug, I would love for people to join us in calling Governor Brown and telling her you're concerned about perennial. Her number is 503-378-4582.
Thanks a lot. We've been talking with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Deneen O'Rourke with 350PDX. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KWU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO, or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute about the future we're beginning to embark on. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Oliver Mitsukusi. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Treka kuvara yerwa, kuyeverwa.